Intersections, Part 2, by Kaneko, read by Dodie Vickers. "Give me a lift back to McMurdo," Rodney says when John arrives the next day with D. Kavanagh, United States. Y. Yamoto, Japan, and R. Yuchenko, Philippines. John's never taken anyone back from 32279 SGA before. Am I allowed to do that? Rodney rolls his eyes. No, I'm a violent escapee from a secret Antarctic prison. And why am I even telling you when someone else could be telling you? He turns around. Yo, security guy. What? Security guy looks up from processing Y. Yamoto and smiles with exaggerated patience. What? Tell Major Paranoid here that this isn't Alcatraz. He can take me to McMurdo. Security guy raises his eyebrows. You can take him, he says to John. Please take him. On the ride over, Rodney chats happily about all the food he's going to buy and how he'll use it to bribe and taunt his co-workers. John keeps one eye on his instruments and the other on Rodney's mouth. The trip seems shorter than normal. When they arrive, John gets out first and helps Rodney down from his seat. He puts a hand on Rodney's hip to steady him. He can't feel anything at all through the quadruple layered clothes, but he imagines Rodney's skin is burning hot. His own skin tingles. So, Rodney says, when both feet are on the ground. He surveys McMurdo, the white sheds, the other white sheds, the blue sheds. What do people do for fun around here? John does hiking for fun. Rodney barks out a surprised laugh. It's a nice laugh. Oh, wait, you're serious, Rodney says. Turns out they have nothing in common whatsoever. It was a bit pretentious, but when Rodney was 13, his favourite number was 2 to the power of 132049 minus 1, the largest known prime. He wrote it out on computer paper. All 39,751 digits, and wrapped it around the walls of his room where his mother's photographs had been when he was 9. Sometimes, when he didn't want to be somewhere, John thought about Einstein's special theory of relativity. He calculated he'd have to be flying at 657.20439 miles per hour to spare himself from his father's favourite lecture, why John will never get anywhere in life. At that speed, John thought, you could go pretty fucking far. Rodney bounces out of bed, whistling happily. It's Monday, shower day. 2 glorious minutes of warmish water and frantic scrubbing. Beautiful, beautiful shower day. He slings a towel over his shoulder. Raindrops keep falling on my head, he sings as he locks the door. He has a stash of Mars bars under the bed. You can't trust scientists with temptation like that. But that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning. Ah! There's a guy standing right in front of the door like a creepy stalker. Hi, he says. Rodney backs up a step. Hi. It's one of the new guys. Eric, he hazards. Kavanagh, Eric says, as in Dr. Derek Kavanagh. He waits an expectant few seconds and then scowls, apparently because Rodney hasn't recognized his name. Rodney sighs to himself. The guy's probably won a couple of minor prizes, a Stacy Fellowship maybe, and now he thinks he's God's gift to the Ancients program. Like Rodney has time to keep up with the scientific community's wrong-headed physics breakthroughs, when it's all been disproved 5 times over in his own, admittedly unpublished, articles. He twirls his hand impatiently. And? What do you want? What? Dr. Eric thrusts a fist-thick boulder at him. I have some suggestions for making the astrophysics department run more smoothly. Oh, goody. I'll get right on that, Rodney lies. He steps around him and heads for his wonderful, wonderful shower. The guy's there again the next morning. You had a chance to look at my suggestions, he says. Tuesday isn't shower day, so Rodney isn't in such a good mood. Look, Carmichael, he says. Kavanagh. Whatever. My ZPM simulations have priority. You have suggestions about that? Let me know. Otherwise, you're between me and my coffee, and that's not a smart place to be. Wednesday's shower day again. Hi there. Rodney waves at Kavanagh with his soap bar. I read your suggestions, thought they were all bad, especially chapter 3. So I take it you're not going to read them? Rodney beams. Nope. On Thursday, Kavanagh follows Rodney from the toilet block into the mess hall and then into Rodney's lab. He explains each of his suggestions point by point. Since you explicitly stated you weren't going to read them. And keeps on explaining, even when Rodney puts his hands over his ears and says, la 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 la. By 8 a.m, Rodney has already drunk his daily ration of 4 coffees. Implemented when the last 2 months' supply ran out after 6 days. And he's gotten no work done at all. He hates Kavanagh with all his heart and his kidney and his spleen. Basically, all of his major organs. After breakfast, Shepherd arrives with a chopper load of new recruits like a shining, shining angel from heaven. Rodney can't rush across the snow fast enough. Kavanagh follows, nagging and crunching rhythmically behind Rodney like something from the Terminator. Major Shepherd, Rodney says. Major Shepherd, I have to go back with you to, he adds when Shepherd raises an eyebrow, to welcome the new arrivals. Shepherd looks around at the new scientists clutching their duffel bags. A tall guy with red hair who looks like Beaker, a woman with Coke bottle glasses, a French guy. To welcome the new arrivals, Shepherd repeats slowly. The next arrivals, Rodney amends quickly. The next set of arrivals. Welcome to you guys too, he says to Beaker. Shepherd looks bland and a little amused. But then he always looks bland and a little amused. Rodney sometimes wonders if there's anything going on inside his head at all. Dr. McKay, Kavanagh says. Rodney clutches Shepherd's arm. He's a desperate man. I have to be in a place with unrationed coffee. Please, I have to. McKay, Shepherd interrupts. Okay, Rodney says. Shepherd shrugs. Sure. Kavanagh says, can I... Nope, Shepherd tells him. He picks up a bag and tosses it easily to the French guy. Only got room for one. Rodney thinks he might be in love. Eric, will you show the new guys to security? He says gloatingly. Kavanagh stares at him for a second, looking delightfully thwarted. Then he turns and marches back to the base, leaving big, stompy footprints in the snow. By the time Rodney was 14, he was the black sheep of the family. His mother had gone back to her photographs, his father to his paintings, and at 5, Jeannie was already a sculptor, carving little animals out of wood and placing them around the house like a cat offering freshly killed gifts. Every time she made a new one, Rodney's mum and dad held off arguing long enough to say, "Oh, what a pretty wooden penguin," or "What an astonishingly lifelike squid," or "Nice crab." Jeannie had quite a thing for sea life. Then they hid the knives in ever more cunning places. Once, Rodney found a paring knife slipped between the pages of the phone book like a pressed flower. Another time, he found a cleaver behind one of his father's paintings, balanced precariously across the hanging wire. In much the same way, he discovered Jeannie's deep religious conviction. He came home to find his parents mid-argument. This wasn't unusual. The but his mother rounded on him and thrust a wooden cross in his face like he was a vampire. That hadn't happened before. "Do you know about this?" she demanded. Rodney had recoiled in surprise, but he leaned in now to look, and also to prove he wasn't a creature of the night. The cross was beautiful. The detail was exquisite. Rodney could see each individual blood drop on Jesus's hands. It was definitely Jeannie's work. "What's the problem? Looks pretty good to me," he said. The problem, it turned out, wasn't really the cross at all. "It is beautiful work, if wholly derivative," his father assured him. The problem was the letter of gushing thanks that had arrived in the mailbox that morning. "Dear Ms. McKay," the letter said, "we are deeply grateful for your generous donation to the church, your order of a Madonna and Child nightlight, Eternity with Christ Holy Bear, 7 Candles of Life, Gift of Grace Child sweatshirt, The 5th Day of Creation stained glass window, St. Francis of Assisi watch, 22 carat gold and 7 diamond crucifix will be filled shortly. We have enclosed our catalogue of Christian rock and sermons on tape, should you wish to donate further." The credit card bill had come at the same time. "This is your fault," Rodney's mother said. She pointed at Rodney's father with the cross in one hand and the damning bill in the other. "It's that school you insisted on." "It's a Caravaggio excursion you insisted on," Rodney's father shouted. "I told you his use of light was too potent for an impressionable young mind. I told you we should have taken her to see the Paul Sandby." "Paul Sandby? You know how I feel about watercolour." "It's not the school," Jeannie interrupted from where she was perched up on the kitchen bench. She had a wooden spoon in her hands, and it was gradually becoming a solemn, bleeding face. "It's not the school, and it's not Caravaggio. It's Reverend Love." It turned out that Reverend Love was a television evangelist who broadcast sermons 3 times a week. "I told you we shouldn't have gotten a television," Rodney's father said. Jeannie mused that if only their mother had known her place and stayed at home like a good wife should, Jeannie would never have discovered the truth about the Lord. God certainly worked in mysterious ways. Rodney's mother threw out the television that same afternoon, and for the next few weekends, she and Jeannie and Rodney's dad visited the National Gallery of Canada, paying special attention to the Impressionists. Rodney stayed home and made a mini hovercraft. He was the envy of his mathematics club, until Dobson Meyer built a full-sized one for the science fair. John's mother turned to religion while John's father was serving in Tehran. It was a short tour, so she didn't have time to do much more than stock up on saint cards and rosary beads and framed prints. John's father didn't say anything when he got home, but when John came downstairs the next morning, all the Madonna and Child pictures were gone. "Well, it was all a bit ostentatious, wasn't it?" his mother said later when he asked her. "We don't need that sort of thing in this household." It becomes a joke between them how little they have in common. "Football," John says, apropos of nothing, "goes beyond sport. It's a game of myth." Rodney rolls his eyes like he's heard it all before. "Oh, please. Football is a game invented by grunting, pre-tool cavemen to while away the time between bear hunting and finger painting. Gladiators facing off against each other," John insists. He waves his peanut butter toast for emphasis. "The great mano a mano of our time." "Hockey," Rodney says, leaning in and raising his voice as though that will help his misguided argument, "is poetry. Poetry with big sticks, and men sliding around with knives on their feet." He smiles and sighs as though he can't express the true beauty of hockey in mere words, then crams the last of his creamed beef on spam on toast into his mouth. He's back in McMurdo today, to help welcome the new arrivals again, he said on the ride over. But sitting at the breakfast table in their brand new coats, Chiang El, China, and Si Russo, Italy, don't look like they feel very welcome, or very well. Will all the food be like this? Chiang El asks tentatively. John grimaces. Just wait till they run out of ketchup. Rodney blinks out of his glazed state. Don't even joke about that. A look of panic crosses his face. They won't really run out of ketchup, will they? I mean, it lasts forever. Tomatoes, vinegar, it's a vegetable. Oh, how. He darts away. When he returns, he's tucking a squeeze bottle inside his coat. What? He says defensively when John looks at him. Like you've never stolen a bottle of ketchup before. Well, okay, I have, John admits. But I was way more discreet. John flies the three of them to SGA. Rodney up front with a can of Spam cradled protectively on his left. Chiang and Russo in the back muttering unhappily to each other. Probably about creamed meat and other perversions. When they land, John gets out to help with the luggage. Rodney tips his head back against the seat like he's going to take a nap. Check in with security over there, he says, waving imperiously. I'm going back with Major Shepherd. John rolls his eyes. McKay? He leans into the open door. I have to load up on some garbage before I go. Rodney shrugs. Okay. John looks at him. Rodney adds reluctantly, would you like some help? John grins. You know what? I think I would. Rodney whines a whole bunch, but works surprisingly hard. He carts at least as much as John does, turning doggedly from the helicopter back to the storage shed, back to the helicopter again. John starts to feel kind of guilty. The guard at the shed looks amused as he ticks off each numbered canister. Don't say a word, Rodney says to him. He tosses another canister into his trolley like it's a Coke can. What? He says, when John winces. Just, there could be anything in there. Anything like empty coffee cans? Like spent fuel rods, asbestos. Rodney laughs out loud. Spent fuel rods? Asbestos? You never know, John says. Or hazardous chemicals. Well, obviously I can't officially put your mind at ease, but... Rodney shakes his head and chuckles. Asbestos. Okay, shut up now, John says. Just let me know if you start breathing funny. I said shut up. Rodney keeps making cracks for the next half hour. You okay? Was that a cough? By the time they're done, John doesn't feel guilty at all. So, yeah, he says, while Rodney's stacking the last of the canisters into his trolley. I'm not actually scheduled to fly back here till Monday. What? He says, when Rodney glares. I needed help. These things are heavy. But I didn't buy all the stuff I wanted, Rodney says. He doesn't stop stacking. Apparently, he's skipping past indignant anger and moving straight from whining into more whining. What am I supposed to do when I run out of coffee? You could ration yourself. 6 a day, maybe. Clearly, you've never experienced caffeine withdrawal. And why am I arguing? Flying people around is what you do. You're an air chauffeur. It's your job to take me. Funny. John tilts his head thoughtfully. I'm pretty sure it's not my job to ferry you back and forth when you have the munchies. Rodney blows out a breath, a little ball of fog in the cold. He's quiet for a moment. John waits patiently. Okay, how about this? Rodney says. Do me a favour and I'll do you one. John has a vivid and unwanted image of Rodney on his knees, mouth dark and open. He forcibly shunts it aside. Oh, really? He says. He hopes he sounds at least a little disinterested. I can fix things. Broken radios, CD players. Nothing I have is broken, John says. He starts shoving his own trolley towards the chopper. It's really freaking heavy. After a few feet, the wheels dig into the snow and stop turning. John walks around and kicks one of the front wheels. When he walks back, the thing still doesn't move. He grits his teeth in frustration. He suddenly wants Rodney to do something, anything that Rodney would never choose to do. He wants Rodney to feel this frustrated. He turns around. I'll take you to Mactown if you come hiking with me. Okay, that's just sadistic. Ask me for something reasonable. John swallows. His throat feels dry, and he is sadistic. I want a hiking buddy. Take it or leave it. Rodney stares at him for a long moment. Fine, he says. John blinks in surprise. Fine, he says. I want to go now. Rodney is still staring at him. Fine. John blinks some more. He feels like he's won something. He's not sure what. Rodney retires to his quarters to lick his wounds, and presumably to change. John goes to sit in the pilot seat and ponder what the hell is wrong with him. He's never wanted a hiking buddy, let alone one who'll complain every second of the trip. It's a long wait. John huddles in his coat. He contemplates flying back on his own. He looks at his watch. He looks at his watch again. He looks at it again. Eventually, Rodney reappears, wearing the puffiest, orangest parka ever stitched together by blind clothes makers. Geez, McKay, John says. Rodney hands him a survival kit. It's bulging at the sides. Just shut up. On the flight to McMurdo, Rodney details his demands. 1 hour of hiking. That's half an hour in one direction and half an hour back. The sun sets at 1900 hours. That's in exactly 6 hours' time. And by then, I expect to be cozy and warm in my own quarters, sipping coffee and eating one of my brand new, delicious power bars that you'll personally have bought for me. We don't stray a single step from the flagged route, and you don't touch my VHF radio. Also, if we fall down a crevasse, I will beat you to death and eat you. John nods. It's a deal. Half an hour each way is about enough time to get to Scott's Cross if they walk fairly fast. At the firehouse, John fills out the "we're going hiking and if we're not back by nightfall, we're probably dead" form. Rodney adds his name and signs it. He hasn't said a word since he made John borrow one of the firehouse survival kits. You can't possibly be carrying enough food in that backpack. His mouth is a straight, grim line. Okay then, John says a little awkwardly. Shall we? Outside, the sun is high and bright in the sky. Rodney slowly thaws under it. I haven't been outdoors in an embarrassingly long time, he says. He sounds almost apologetic. He can't seem to stop looking around at the buildings and the snow and the sky. I used to go walking a little, he adds. He takes off his woolen hat and scrubs his hand through his hair. There's a park near my apartment. I ate lunch there sometimes. Okay, once. I ate there once, but it was quite pleasant. By the time they get to the base of Observation Hill, the grim lines around Rodney's mouth have relaxed. He tears open one of his survival kit chocolate bars. You should get me apple and walnut bars, he says, his mouth full. And maybe cranberry and pecan. I prefer the apricot, John says. Rodney swallows his mouthful. I'm shocked by our divergent tastes. Back in McMurdo, it had almost been too warm for a coat. But the wind picks up as they start to climb. Rodney stumbles and slips on the loose gravel and snow. Oh yeah, I can see why this is a popular pastime, he says. John grabs his wrist to steady him when he slips the second time. Okay, he says. Shut up, I'm thinking about coffee, Rodney snaps. He stops abruptly and sniffs the air. Do you smell pollen? We're in Antarctica. Because I'm allergic. We're in Antarctica. Ragweed pollen can travel up to 400 miles with the right winds. Will you just keep walking? John says, exasperated. You're getting me some Mars bars now too, Rodney says. He hoists himself higher. Apple walnut, he mumbles to himself. A can. Higher up, the wind blows in heavy gusts that buffet them sideways. Volcanic rocks are strewn like litter. They pass the old nuclear reactor, and then it's all steep, steep climbing. There's snow everywhere now, and Rodney's panting more than talking. His cheeks are bright red. The wind makes his hair flutter crazily. He grins and holds out his hand to help John around a tricky boulder. I can almost see the appeal of this, he gasps. John grips his hand and scrambles up. Really? Rodney shakes his head. No, I think you're completely insane. He lets go of John's hand, but he doesn't stop grinning until they get to the summit. Up top, the wind dies down suddenly and miraculously. Rodney wipes his sleeve over his face. I'm dead, but I'm in so much pain I haven't realized it yet. You seriously do this for fun? John points wordlessly beyond the edge. Oh, Rodney says. He walks to where the ground ends in a sharp drop. Oh, wow. He turns a slow, wandering circle, staring out at McMurdo, Mount Erebus, Scott Base, and the white nothingness of the Ross Ice Shelf. White Island, Black Island, John's runway. Nothingness. More nothingness. McMurdo again. Mount Erebus. You should see it at dawn, John says. He knows he's smiling dopily. He doesn't care. Holy shit! Rodney laughs and shakes his head. We're in Antarctica. God, we're in Antarctica. John smiles wider. He closes his eyes and tips his head back. The air feels like sandpaper. His fingertips ache with the cold. He loves this place. He thinks if he died here, he'd die happy. John isn't sure how long he stands there, mesmerized by the emptiness. But at some point he blinks, and he's back on the ground. There's fog at his feet, thick enough and white enough to walk on. John has a moment of disorientation. He lurches forward a step, jerks back. The shadows are too dark, he thinks. The sky is too dark. Rodney's looking at the cross now, fingering the inscription where it says, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. He looks wistful. Those early explorers were something, weren't they? John nods. Yeah, they were. His watch says 1600 hours. It's definitely too dark. I may have some bad news, he starts to say, but Ronnie's radio crackles to life before he can finish. Mac Ops, weather, it says. The wind starts again suddenly, like it's been on pause. Dry snow swirls around John's knees above the fog. Rodney is already shaking his head. I knew this was going to happen. You knew the radio was going to come on? I knew we were going to die up here. We're not going to die, John says. No one's ever died on Ob Hill. He looks around, assessing the terrain. You're way more likely to get run over by a bus. Oh, God. You're one of those people who says things like, you're more likely to get attacked by a cow than a shark. Well, I'll tell you. I'd rather get attacked by a cow. At least I'd have some chance of punching out Daisy's lights. develop into, return to, the radio says. I just wanted coffee, Ronnie says, and then I was going to spend the afternoon working, and maybe watching Kamenetsky's Incredible Hulk DVDs. You bribed me into coming up here. Hey, here's an idea. Let's get the hell off this rock, and you can do the blame thing later. John snatches the radio from him. Put your hat on. How is putting my hat on going to help? John rolls his eyes. He clicks the radio. Mac Ops, this is Shepard. Please say again. He clicks the radio off. Fine, give me the hat, and I'll put it on over the hat I'm already wearing. And maybe I won't have to hear you talking. The radio says, develop into condition 2. Suggest you return to Mac. Roger that, John says. He shoves the radio into his backpack. Come on. Wait, you rogered that? I didn't roger that. McKay, John says warningly. McKay, okay. Rodney pulls his hat on and starts scrambling to the trail. They make it about halfway, with snow blowing faster and faster, before the storm roars in for real. Well, John says, this just got interesting. He can't see below his knees. Rodney is a flash of orange and movement behind swirling white. Major, Rodney says. He sounds carefully not panicked. It's a whiteout. I know what it is. What are we going to do? This could last hours. Days. We'll be dead from exposure before anyone finds us, if we don't fall down and break our necks first. John bites his lip. He'd be fine if they were flying. But in a jet, he'd have instruments, radar. Right now, he isn't even sure which way he's facing, let alone where the flagged route is. He takes a deep breath. All right, he says. We could climb up. Please tell me there's an oar coming. Or we could climb down. And door number 3? We stay here and hope it dies down. Door number 4? John glares, even though there's no way Rodney will see the glare. There aren't an infinite number of doors. I'm really not a fan of the other 3. I guess we could set up one of the tents. You know, I always thought I'd die in a car accident. Or maybe of a heart attack. This is so much worse. Or I could shove you off the edge right now. You know which way the edge is? No? Then stop with the empty threats, Rodney says. Let's get a damn tent up. I need a coffee so bad. That you'd eat it out of the packet? That you should seriously shut up and help me with the tent already. They could probably rebuild civilization with the contents of Rodney's survival kit. A fairly nice civilization, actually, with video games and Tang. John finds a good sharp knife and cuts off 10 feet of parachute cord. Just in case we lose each other, he says. He ties one end around Rodney's waist and loops the other end around his own waist. Hey, that's ingenious. So when you fall off the edge, I will too. So if I fall off the edge, you can drop down limp and we'll both survive. John pulls the knot tight. It isn't easy with wet mittens. Okay, I'm going to circle you. Hopefully there'll be room to put up the tent right here. This really, really sucks. Just don't wander off, John tells me. You're my anchor. Oh, thank you. Because I'm so stupid, I didn't understand the concept of you circling me. While John crawls around, feeling in front of him for cliff edges and crevasses, Rodney calls out helpful things like, I'm eating one of the chocolate bars now, and aren't you glad I reminded you to bring a survival kit? And can you get a move on? Man dying of exposure here. It feels like forever before John smacks headfirst into the stake he used to mark the beginning of the circle. "We can set up the tent now," he shouts. He rubs his head. He suspects this is going to be a long day. It takes another forever before they get the tent stakes hammered in and the tent put up, anchored with snow flukes. Rodney's snow saw, and the biggest mound of snow John can shovel on top. Then John makes Rodney sit inside the tent and press against the base of the walls while John packs snow and gravel against the outside. At the end of it, they collapse in the tent on the coldish ground sheet, John coughing up snow and dirt, Rodney staring blankly up at the ceiling. John hasn't felt like this since basic training. They lay there for quite a while. At some point, the radio crackles. John fumbles it out of his pack. "Shepherd here," he mumbles. "Major? You expected 10 minutes ago." "Roger that, Mac Ops. We're stuck on Observation Hill. We're fine though. Got a tent up. We're going to wait it out." "Roger that. Out." John lets the radio fall out of his hand. "We should take off our coats," Rodney says. "Yep," John says. "Maybe get out the sleeping bags." "Good idea." They lie there a while longer. John wonders whether he can light the cook stove in a little tent like this without poisoning them both. "There was this episode of The Twilight Zone," Rodney says, interrupting his wondering, "where a man suddenly finds himself on a movie set, and he's playing himself in a film. His whole life is suddenly just a film. I only saw half of it. Always wondered what happened at the end. I guess now I'll never know." John groans. "We're not going to die, Rodney." He sits up finally and starts stripping off his wet gear. Mittens, coat, outer pants, shoes, socks. He wrestles his sleeping bag out of the kit and kicks it open. Rodney sits up too, unbuttons his jacket. "Katabatic winds, Major. Antarctic winds with the force of a hurricane. They gather speed by rolling down mountains." "Seriously, the only way you're going to die today is if I kill you." "We're on a mountain." "We're on a hill. And in a couple of hours, we'll be off the hill and buying you Mars bars. Also, I made a windbreak. We'll be fine." "But how tight did you pack that snow?" "Tight," John says. He roots around until he finds some dry socks and mittens. He climbs into his sleeping bag. "You think I can light the stove?" "No vents. No spot detector." Rodney unrolls his own bag and crawls in. "The carbon monoxide would kill us both before the water even boiled." "Oh, man." He makes a sound that's somewhere between a fuck me harder grunt and a moan. "Warm. Oh, God, this is warm." "That's what I thought," John says. He tries to ignore the porn noises. "They're sardines in a very small tin." Rodney's close enough to jerk him off. Close enough to kiss. John rolls over so he's facing the wall. But if anything, that's worse. He can hear Rodney breathing behind him. It's as intimate as if they were sharing a bed. Rodney shifts and his knee pokes at John's back, and John feels it right down his spine. His breath catches. He imagines Rodney's mouth on the back of his neck. He squeezes his eyes shut. This isn't him, he thinks. His breath doesn't catch if he doesn't want it to. He doesn't think about things he doesn't want to. He breathes in. He breathes out. Nice and steady. After a moment, he's back in control. His breath is calm without him having to work for it. Behind him, Rodney makes a little rustling noise, like maybe he's sliding a hand down his pants. And then a louder rustling noise, like he might be jerking off. John can't take it. He rolls back over. Rodney's sitting up in his sleeping bag, writing furiously on a notepad, What are you doing? John says. Oh, just some stuff, Rodney says. He doesn't stop writing. The first page is already half covered with equations. Nothing John recognizes. Stuff? John says. He's curious and unreasonably irritated. And Rodney smells so goddamn fucking good. He's going nuts. He's losing it out here. Stuff that people might need. Stuff that shouldn't die with me. Do you mind? I really need to concentrate. John closes his eyes. The writing rustling sounds, like jerking off again. He opens his eyes. Rodney shifts, nudging John's shoulder. John rides out the shiver of pleasure like he'd ride out pain in the middle of a mission. Rodney shifts again, bumping John's arm. He starts his next line of messy equations. He shifts and nudges, shifts and nudges. John pulls his hands out of the sleeping bag so he isn't tempted to brush them over his cock. If he could just... Rodney shifts, nudges, shifts, nudges, shifts, nudges. John grinds his teeth. Every touch feels like a warm hand on his cock. He's being jerked off in water torture increments. He could come like this, and it would take hours, weeks. Rodney's pencil flies across the page. He doesn't hesitate or scratch anything out, just writes and writes and writes and flips to the next page, scrolling stuff that people might need. Stuff that shouldn't die with him, like he's writing a grocery list. John can't look away, and it makes no sense, this infatuation. Rodney's nothing like John's type. Back home, John wouldn't look at Rodney twice in a crowd. He certainly wouldn't be lying here, enthralled by him, needing him. John doesn't need anyone. He forces his gaze to the ceiling. He thinks, the four forces on an aircraft are lift, thrust, drag, and weight. Lift equals the coefficient times air density times velocity squared over 2 times the wing area. Thrust equals force over the mass flow rate equals 1 plus the ratio of fuel to air times the exit velocity minus the free stream velocity. Drag equals the coefficient times air density times velocity squared over 2 times the reference area. Weight equals mass times gravitational acceleration. He thinks, if an FA-18A Hornet is cruising at 700 miles per hour, then L equals CI times R times A times V squared over 2. L equals 1.8 times 1.31 times 37.2 times 11265.40.8 over 3600 squared over 2 equals 4294826 newtons. When he turns his head, his mouth is right next to Rodney's thigh. Rodney, he says, I really want to suck your cock. Rodney doesn't stop writing. He flips the page over and writes, for background, see Gall's work on stellar dynamics. When I said I needed to concentrate, I of course meant, please interrupt me whenever you feel like it. His elbow knocks John's shoulder, and John's cock jerks in response. John bites off a grunt. He can't take it. He's so goddamn hard. He's losing his mind. Stop, he says. He sits up. Stop. Stop. Rodney stops, but only to roll his eyes at him. You're bored already? I guess we could play tic-tac-toe. I mean, it would take up a page, so we'd be depriving humanity of an entire branch of subatomic physics. But if you really need some entertainment, John leans in and kisses him. Rodney makes a startled noise, and then they're really kissing, and Rodney's mouth is hot and wet and open for him. and John's never been hungry like this before. He wraps his hands around the back of Rodney's neck, tips Rodney's head back so that the angle is better, so that John can take what he needs. He jerks back. Rodney's still holding the notepad. He looks dazed. Wow, that was... John swallows. His throat feels rough. The storm outside fills the silence. I don't have feelings like this. You... Rodney quirks his mouth wryly. Right. And now he does put down the notepad. John has no idea what to say. Apparently, neither does Rodney. They watch the dark silhouette of a snow clump slide down the roof. John thinks he might be able to make it back to Mactown if it's just him. It couldn't be harder than sitting in this tiny freaking tent with the man he just kissed. Rodney clears his throat. His mouth is a tight, unhappy line. And John wants to touch him so badly that he can feel Rodney's lips against his fingers like a phantom ache. It occurs to me, Rodney says, that in an awkward situation, being stuck in a small tent in the middle of a violent snowstorm could have some drawbacks. John shakes his head. I'm sorry. Yes, well, you don't have feelings like this, Rodney says. He picks up his notepad, puts it down again. He isn't looking at John. No, I haven't had feelings like this. I haven't wanted this in a long time. John grips out. The nudging wasn't torture. This is torture. This explaining himself. And now I don't know. Rodney doesn't answer. Still doesn't look at him. The silence is unbearable. Then Rodney says, before I came here, I spent 11 months in Siberia. Yes, I know. But one afternoon, in the middle of a working day, I had a mini orgy with 3 lab techs on a frozen beach. And well, firstly, you seriously don't want to know where I got frostbite. But secondly, it wasn't something I'd normally do. Well, I don't think so, anyway. Maybe I would, except the opportunities don't arise. He pauses and smiles. It was really quite something. John digests this. You think I have some kind of, what, ice fever? Antarctic-induced temporary gayness? How should I know? Rodney says dismissively. Do I look like a therapist? I'm just saying, don't beat yourself up, Major. People sometimes do inexplicable things. That's why we don't make good science projects. As far as I'm concerned, it never happened. I say, what gay kiss in the emergency snow shelter? Oh, well, that's very understanding of you. Rodney waves a hand. I might blackmail you into flying me around a few times. I'm only human. John laughs a little shakily. That would be fine. It makes sense for it to go down like this, John thinks, as Rodney recovers his notepad from under his coat and his pencil from under John's sleeping bag. When the storm ends, he'll take Rodney back to the weapon in progress. And 2 months from now, he'll ship out to Australia, or Germany, or Korea, or the Gulf. And this would just be the time he went a little nuts out on the ice. Rodney scratches out 3 equations he's just written. He has nice hands. I'm so glad we were able to handle this like adults, he says. John nods absently. Me too. And I'm particularly impressed with myself, Rodney says. He crosses out another equation in the middle of writing it. Because usually, I'm a total slut. God, John thinks. And if he had it together for a minute there, he's lost it again. Rodney as a slut. John's dick loves that idea. Strains painfully against his briefs. John thinks, Rodney on his hands and knees, begging for it. Rodney, working John's mouth with his cock, hands fisting John's hair. And Rodney saying, out of all the people who have come on to me, you're at least top three, maybe even top two, in terms of hotness. I mean, you're... He shakes his head appreciatively. You are really hot. You are really, really freaking hot. And he coughs. Well, anyway, it was for the best. Because at this stage of my life, I really don't want to have to deal with someone who doesn't even know. John can't take it. I want to suck your cock, he blurts out. Whether he likes men, Rodney says. He blinks, deer in headlights, and his pencil rolls out of his hand. His eyes drop to John's mouth. John knows how to seduce someone. He smiles at them, he flirts with them, he takes them out to dinner. Now, though, here, with Rodney, he has none of that finesse. This isn't seduction. This is blunt force desperation. Sweat trickles down the back of his neck. The tent is shivering and snow is pushing at the walls. But John feels hot all over. He can't breathe. Rodney, he says, I had really... He shapes the words, but his voice dries up. He tries again. I want to suck you off. I can't stop thinking about all the ways I want to. Okay? Rodney interrupts. His eyes are dark. He grimaces at John apologetically. Told you I was easy. Okay, John says. Or thinks he says. Maybe he doesn't say anything. He's already kissing Rodney again. And God, has he been starving for this? He slides his tongue into Rodney's mouth, over and over and over, until they're both breathing in hitching gasps. And John can't catch his breath. He can't bring himself to stop. He whimpers in protest when Rodney pulls back. Rodney flushes. If you want to, you better. Soon. Oh, John says. He huffs it into the side of Rodney's neck, pressing a grin against the same spot when Rodney shudders. It's not that... Look, it's been a while. Rodney says, a little defensively. Yeah? John bites gently, and that gets him a fantastic sighing noise. He turns Rodney's face and kisses him again before he can answer. He pulls back and puts a gentle hand on Rodney's chest, presses him onto his back. God, Rodney says. He lifts his hips pleadingly. Come on. John works Rodney's fly open with the one hand. He flicks open a button, two buttons, three. Eases him out. And he can't believe how much he needs this. How much he's missed the weight and heat and musk of another guy's cock. He can't help himself. He bends down and licks the head of it, eyes sliding closed ecstatically at Rodney's loud groan. He's going to come in his pants, he thinks. When he glances back up, Rodney's staring at him, mouth parted, looking fascinated, and maybe a little disbelieving. John grins up at him, opens his mouth, and slides down slow, slow, so Rodney can see exactly what he's getting. Rodney makes a choked noise, and John slides down deep as he can take it, a little deeper than that. His throat spasms and his eyes water, and he can already feel a twinge where his jaw is going to ache later. But even that feels fucking fantastic. He backs off, and when he slides down again, he doesn't choke at all, like riding a bike. He wants to draw this out, thinks he could suck cock all day, but Rodney's already groaning like he's going to die. Like he's been nursing that erection for a while. John sucks him, and it's so fucking perfect. This right here is heaven, he thinks. this hard dick working his throat. He comes moaning around Rodney's cock, humping Rodney's sleeping bag, and Rodney rides his moans, thrusting up into his mouth. Rodney loses it pretty soon after that, pushes hard once, twice, three times. Huck, he gasps. Huck, fuck, fuck. He tips his head up, face tight, and then he's pulsing in John's throat. They both lie there panting a while. Rodney stares at the ceiling. John stares at the wall. Eventually, Rodney turns his head to look at him. That was wow, he says. That was great. That was really, really, really great. I mean, hiking. Who knew? John laughs. His mouth tastes like Rodney. He feels drunk. Who knew? He echoes. John gets into his sleeping bag and they doze a bit after that. It's darker when John wakes again and still snowing hard. There are more dark silhouettes above them, but the roof seems to be holding up. John shuts his eyes and then opens them again. He drags himself up, pulls on his pants and his coat, his socks, his shoes, his hat, his gloves. He wraps a scarf around his mouth and digs out a snow shovel from his kit. Then he goes out to scrape off the snow clumps that haven't managed to slide off. When he comes back in, the tent smells like sex. He slides into his bag, and Rodney wakes up just long enough to roll closer. He says to John, the roof. Taking care of it, John says. He kisses Rodney's ear. Go back to sleep. They doze. When John's awake again, it's night. He stares into the blackness, and after a while, the sound of Rodney's snores shifts vaguely from annoying to kind of sexy. John presses a kiss to what might be Rodney's sleeping bag, then higher up on Rodney's sleeping bag, then what's probably Rodney's jaw. The roof, Rodney whispers suddenly, making John jump. I scraped it down, John whispers back. There's a light bumping noise, and then a rustling noise, and then more bumping. And suddenly, John can see. Rodney has a flashlight in his hand. He shines it at the ceiling. I just said I scraped it down, John says in his normal voice. Oh, I'm sorry if I wanted to check, Rodney snaps. I mean, it's not like this shelter is between us and certain death or anything. John rolls his eyes. But then Rodney has a hand on his chin, and they're kissing. When he pulls back, John's forgotten what he was annoyed about. He unzips his own sleeping bag. Then he grins his most charming grin, and unzips Rodney's bag, nice and slow and porn movie. And Rodney's already breathing unevenly. Rodney's fly is still open. John closes his eyes for just a second. When he opens his eyes again, Rodney's asleep, snoring into John's neck. John slides a hand into Rodney's bag sleepily. He strokes his ribs, his arm. He closes his eyes. He wakes up with his fist around Rodney's cock, and Rodney's already moaning in his sleep. John squeezes him gently, and Rodney moans louder. His breath is fast and hot against John's neck. John squeezes and releases, and Rodney's eyes flutter open. Hey, John says. Rodney's mouth works for a second, though he's forgotten how to do anything but make porn noises. Hey, he says. John licks at the underside of Rodney's jaw, kisses the corner of his mouth. Lets Rodney fluff his hand. He watches Rodney's face grimace and relax and grimace. Rodney huffs loudly and gracelessly, and it's the hottest thing John's seen in his life. Which is weird, because John's dated women so gorgeous they didn't seem real. John squeezes him tighter, And then Rodney's really humping John's fist, eyes wide and unseeing. And there's nothing unreal about him, with his soft, sedentary body, and his mussed hair, and his flushed, unshaven face. "Yeah," John whispers. He presses his forehead against Rodney's collarbone. "Yeah, come all over my hand." Rodney groans, hot and dirty, and spurts into John's fist. "Holy crap," he gasps. John smiles against Rodney's shoulder, feels a kiss pressed into his hair, then another kiss. "You are a freaking amazing," Rodney says. John lifts his head for a proper kiss. Then he unzips Rodney's sleeping bag the rest of the way and crawls over to straddle him, brings his own bag over to blanket them both. "You're still dressed," Rodney says, reaching for him. "Come here." He flips open John's fly and pushes down his pants and his sticky underwear. John kicks them the rest of the way off and then helps Rodney out of his own pants. "Is there, he says, while Rodney's still struggling with the kicking off part. "Stuff." "Survival kit," Rodney says. John strokes Rodney's bare hip and stretches over him to root through the bag. He pulls out a signal mirror, a plastic mug, socks, food bars, a paperback novel, more food bars, a handful of pencils, MREs, more MREs, another pencil, more MREs. How many fucking MREs did a person need? Until he comes up with a sunscreen tube. "Now I know where pencils go to die," he says, shaking the tube. He uncaps the top. Rodney says distractedly. He's running his hands up and down John's thighs with a flatteringly smug cat-with-the-cream expression. He holds a palm out for the sunscreen. "Did I mention you're hot?" "Couple of times," John says, grinning. And then Rodney starts jerking him off, slow and hot and slick. And he can't hold on to the grin. All his mouth wants to do is moan. Rodney is shockingly good with his hands. He jacks him until John's making embarrassing, helpless noises and pushing up blindly into Rodney's fist. "Come on, come on," John mutters. He puts his hand over Rodney's to make him go faster. But Rodney just pushes him away and then lets go of him altogether. "What? No," John says, and he knows Rodney's hand is gone. But his hips keep humping thin air for a few seconds, like his body is on time delay. "Your hand," he protests. He can hear the whine in his voice. Rodney taps his thigh, sending little shivery jolts right through John's body. "Kneel up," he says. "Come on." He slides a hand up John's side. "Let me turn over. I want you to fuck me." "Oh," John says. He licks his lips. "Why? Okay." Even Rodney turning over between his thighs is almost enough to make John lose it. He clenches his teeth and tries to think about things other than his cock sliding into Rodney's perfect round ass. And God, he thinks, when Rodney settles onto his stomach, it is perfect. He runs his thumb down the crease and Rodney groans. John slides a single finger in first. That gets him a nice moan. Two fingers make Rodney grunt and start to shake. John strokes his side. "Okay," he says. "Okay, yes, yes, do it," Rodney says impatiently. "Do it already." So John spreads him and pushes in. Gently. Then a little harder as he realizes how easily Rodney's taking him. He pulls out, pushes in again and again, until Rodney's shaking and making mindless noises like he loves this so much he's going to die. And John feels the way Rodney's hips move as he pounds into him. and he thinks there's no way he could ever get enough of this. Afterwards, when he's recovered enough to speak, Rodney says, "So, have you done a lot of ass fucking?" John chokes. "What?" "Obviously, I mean with women," Rodney says, rolling his eyes. "Don't start getting all freaked out." "I'm not freaked," John says. "No, I haven't done a lot of ass fucking with women. It's just that you seem suspiciously good at it, like you knew what you were doing." "Well, I guess I'm just a natural," John snaps. "I guess you are," Rodney says. He sounds slightly disgruntled. That's the end of part 2 of Intersections by Kaneko.